pleasure to welcome Byron King in his debut appearance on Gold Seek Radio with insights on the recent gold market correction, as well as a potential buying opportunity. A gold and mining expert and editor of Jim Rickard's Gold Speculator, as well as contributor to Jim Rickard's Strategic Intelligence. Welcome to the show, Mr. King.
Hello, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us today. And I wonder if you'd like to share any other interesting tidbits regarding your CV or your background for our listeners today.
For people who aren't aware, I'm a newsletter writer with Agora Financial of Baltimore. I've lived an interesting life, I would say. I mean, I studied geology, mostly geochemistry, mineralogy, crystallography back in my university days. I worked in the oil industry. I spent time in the U.S. Navy. I was active duty. I was a reservist. I've spent a lot of time over the last, 25 years in the resource industry, on the energy side, on the mining side. I am very comfortable and very familiar with geological issues, mining issues, engineering type issues. And then, of course, because money is the crux of how all this works. No buck Rogers, like the man said in the movie The Right Stuff. I'm very savvy about, how it all happens on Wall Street and Bay Street and what have you. So we have right now the newsletter Rickard's Gold Speculator with Byron King. Jim Rickard's is the international economist, I suppose I'd call him, who, sort of looks at the big macro picture. He's a very mathematics-driven guy. I mean, he is not an arm-waving economist. He's got the math to back it up. He's got a degree from Johns Hopkins, so he knows a few things. And he's a consultant to the U.S. Treasury Department and even to the CIA. He's done war games with the CIA on financial war, just like up at the Naval War College, which I attended at one point. We used to do war gaming, we shoot cruise missiles, they shoot cruise missiles. The CIA does financial war gaming where, what happens when somebody tries to crash the economy or the currency of a whole other country. That's Jim's side. And then I am, the geological and the mining, investment side of the newsletters. And so the two of us form a tag team, you might say, but I don't mean that in any kind of world wrestling sort of way. There's nothing overly scripted about what we do. We follow the facts.
So I thought we might begin the discussion with the, of course, precious metals, as we alluded to. In the past few weeks, we've seen the gold and silver stocks recoil from a remarkable advance, giving up some of the gains. Would you say that this is a value opportunity for investors, with a portfolio mindset?
I think it is, yes. We obviously had a very, very healthy gold-silver upswing over the summers, particularly after Brexit on June 23rd, 24th, where the UK determined to leave the EU. I mean, most people, 90% of everybody said, oh, it'll never pass, whatever. Our side, the Jim Rickard's and Byron King side, we actually were leaning very heavily that it would pass. We were very contrarian in that sense. We were positioned investment-wise. So we did well. Gold and silver, rose, obviously, over the summer, if you followed it. Starting around early, mid-August, we had sort of a gentle slide. What's been going on for the last several months is this Fed talk, Federal Reserve talk about, oh, we're going to raise those interest rates. We might raise those interest rates. And, we're the Jackson Hole. We're going to raise some interest rates. Every time the Fed, because they're jawboning interest rates, and then they come away saying, well, not right now. Okay, what happened a couple weeks ago, because your question was, the gold price swoon of about 3 weeks ago. What happened was the market finally figured out the Federal Reserve will, 98% probability raise interest rates at its December meeting, December 15th, something thereabouts, middle of the month. And so I think that it's fair to say that this gold price swoon of a couple of weeks ago was a market reaction all at once, sort of a market crystallization, you might say, of the realization that, yes, the Fed will raise interest rates. And so, boom, gold, silver prices dropped. It was a quick readjustment. It took down a lot of share prices with it. And now, looking forward, the next couple of months, the next, say 6 to 8 weeks, let's say, obviously we have the U.S. election, big, huge wild cards there. That is an odd factor there. Then we have the post-election because, one side wins, one side loses. This is a change election where the American people want change, but, the change that that is being offered is very frustrating to one half of the population or the other half of the population. And so we're going to have to deal with that. But then we will almost certainly see a Federal Reserve rate increase in December. And you say, well, gee, why would they do that? Well, because they've been talking about it so long that, and they couldn't do it up to now just because the economy was weak. They will do it just because they have to do it. And, I mean, they're going to raise rates, in a sense, only so that they have something to lower, you know, a month or two later. Because when they do raise rates, market-wise, economy-wise, global-wise, I mean, you name it, it's going to be a total situation where things start hitting the fan in the weeks and month or two after they raise rates in December.
Absolutely. You know, the Fed funds futures clearly indicate at least twice the odds of a rate hike in December by the FOMC meeting. And policymakers are more than likely then going to pull the trigger, although they have balked in the past. Clearly, we have an economy that's been on life support systems since at least 2009, I think you could argue. The Fed's balance sheet, last check, something around $4.5 trillion. And add in their nearly zero interest rates, we're seeing that on both sides of the ponds, right? I mean, we have the BOJ and the ECB and the PBOC, the Bank of Sweden as well, and a few others in negative territory. This seems to be a theme, but the Fed is going to buck the trend. They're actually going to raise rates. How might the dominoes fall once the Fed raises rates?
Well, when the Fed raises rates, one of the very first things that will happen is that the broad market indexes, you know, sort of the Dow, the S&P 500, will drop precipitously. They will almost instantly begin to drop. I mean, there probably will be some selling, you know, leading into it as well. This is going to be mid-December, obviously. A lot of people will be, you know, getting ready for the Christmas, New Year holidays and things like that. But as December unwinds, so will the stock market. And then likely into January, I think we're going to have a continuing swoon into January. We could see a 10%, 15%, and even a 20% market tumble in the month or so after they raise rates. And that's going to shave a lot of points off the Dow and off the S&P. In terms of precious metals, we might see another swoon in precious metal prices as well. You know, the price of gold, silver, and then, you know, by relationship or by the optionality factor, the mining industry as well. But when that happens, that's really going to be the point at which, you know, the world realizes that, you know, that even the mighty Fed, the almighty Fed, you know, has feet of clay. I mean, that what they're doing is the absolute wrong thing. And quite frankly, I think in the world of central bankers, they don't know collectively where to go and what to do at this point, because their entire educational process, their entire schooling system, their career path, the publisher-parish path at the universities that, you know, that feed people into these type of jobs and these type of positions, it is all based on, you know, a monetarist slash Keynesian approach to things, where if they adjust interest rates one way or the other, or if they play around with the value of these fiat currencies, that they can somehow manage the economy and kill the business cycle. And really, you would have to be a relatively old economist to have studied in an academic sense the idea of gold back in school, unless maybe you went to the Colorado School of Mines or something and you studied it there, you know, because you're a mineral economist or something. But most of the people who run the monetary world don't have a clue about gold and hard assets, and they are rather disdainful of it, except that they are going to come back around to hard assets, gold, silver, as a component of some sort of a global monetary base. And that's the thesis behind, you know, why gold and silver are excellent investments moving forward. I mean, some days are better than others. You have up days, you have down days. But the general trend over the next two or three years, the next trend over the next two or three years is up, up, and more up, with, you know, bumps and as we make our way across.
One of the interesting plays, of course, of the precious metals is the leverage that one can boost the portfolio's bottom line using the mining sector. And you've been watching the sector very closely, and you have found some gems, if you will, or nuggets, one of them being Brazil Resources, a big favorite of ours here at Goldseek and Silverseek. You've actually put out a buy noting that this exploration firm, and I quote here, the most underpriced company in the gold speculator's portfolio.
I've been following Brazil Resources. I certainly admire and respect the management. I mean, I've known the management of Brazil Resources since the days of in the uranium business, uranium UEC, Uranium Exploration Company, which they are still running. So they did a very, very, very good job of turning a bunch of just, you know, sagebrush and empty scrub grass, you know, in the Texas prairie into a working uranium operation. You know, I mean, a lot of people can talk a good talk, but these guys can actually, you know, walk the talk, I guess is how is the expression. So they did that in the uranium side. So first of all, I like the management. Secondly, yes, in terms of their asset base, they rolled up a number of gold plays in Brazil, hence the name Brazil Resources. Then they picked up a very intriguing asset in Alaska, very, very far apart from Brazil, you know, but that asset stands on its own. And then they picked up this asset from Copper, which is an Alaska company focused way up in the Brooks Range. And, you know, they had this other asset down in Colombia. And so they picked up that asset in Colombia. So they have three excellent groups of assets, Brazil, Alaska, and Colombia. And so now the question is, okay, great, you've got three assets in three, you know, geographic, highly different parts of the world. You know, what are you going to do with them? Well, first of all, what are you going to do with them is you're going to apply your good management to them, you know, because anybody can have a good asset, and if they don't know what they're doing. You know, the idea of an exploration-type company is that they will take an asset and they will move that asset, you know, they'll move the ball down the field in terms of developing the asset. I mean, I don't anticipate that Brazil Resources is going to turn into the next, you know, Barrick Gold company with big, huge mines like out in Nevada or something like that. You know, what I do anticipate is that Brazil Resources will take, you know, one or two or all three of those assets, and they will do the type of work in terms of drilling, in terms of development, in terms of building a resource profile that will make these assets very, very marketable to other intermediate-sized companies or a large company, you know, to the gold groups or the gold corps of the world, the Barrick Golds of the world, the Kinrosses of the world, that, you know, that kind of thing. So when you look at the what I call the enterprise value per ounce, you know, what is the company trading for on the stock market as opposed to what is its resource in the ground, you know, the, you know, measured and indicated, you know, how many ounces of gold or how many pounds of copper or whatever, you know, when you look at that as opposed to much of the rest of what's out there, I think Brazil Resources is extremely undervalued. And as you noted, I've said that in my newsletter. I think that they are an absolute bargain. And, you know, in the next, you know, month or two or three, as we go through the election and the post-election and the interest rates and this and that, you know, there are going to be good days and bad days. The market's going to do what the market's going to do. I don't know why the market does what it does. But in terms of the long-term prospect for this company, they have the assets, they have the management, they have money, and they can raise money to do what you need to do in terms of drilling it up and defining the asset and getting it to a point where it will be marketable and monetizable, if that's a word, to some other party who wants to JV with them or who wants to buy them out or somehow, maybe, you know, work some sort of a deal.
Very good. Well, Brazil Resources certainly seems very well positioned in the new bull market for precious metals equities. What are your thoughts on a return to another gold standard?
One of the criticisms of the old gold standard was that you had ups and downs and panics and the markets would crash and people, the banks would go under and people would go broke. And, you know, to which I say, yeah, so what? You know, I mean, we've had ups and downs and crashes and panics and banks going broke and people losing everything under, you know, the non-gold standard as well. And in terms of academe, I didn't mentioned, you know, when you asked me about my background, my undergraduate work was at Harvard. Okay, I studied geology at Harvard. There was a woman who was teaching economics back then at Harvard. She was an associate professor by the name of Janet Yellen. And yes, it's that Janet Yellen. She grew up to become the, you know, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And I still have my course books, you know, the course catalogs that you get when now it's all online, but in the olden days, when you would go to college, they would give you a book, and it had all the different courses in it that and who taught them and when they were and what have you. I mean, every college did something like this, you know. And so I for some strange reason, because I'm a pack rat, I guess, which my wife hates, I kept those books over the years. A few months ago, just as a curiosity, because Jim Rickards asked me about it, I looked up the old course catalogs from 1973 and 4 and 5 and 6 and whatever, when Janet Yellen was teaching at Harvard. What was she teaching? She was teaching courses in Keynesian economics, in sort of a central planning, a central bank programming approach to running the economy. I mean, this is the stuff. This is her academic bread and butter. This is Janet Yellen's DNA intellectually, in terms of, you know, how she thinks she can run the world and how she runs the Fed in a policy sense. I mean, you know, Janet Yellen, I assure you, did not go up to the geology department at Harvard and co-teach a course in, you know, mineral economics or something like that. Her shadow never darkened the door of the Agassiz Laboratory at Harvard in terms of geology and mineralogy or minerals or anything like that.
Regarding the idea of interest rates and, of course, monetary policy, Fed policymakers might actually reverse course on rates and stop at maybe 75 basis points or 100 basis points early 2017, and then backtrack on rates and perhaps take us into unprecedented levels, even negative territory, that makes it difficult, I think, to project what we'll see in the coming years.
With what it means for investors, and I'll take you back to January 20 and 21st of this year, of 2016. I woke up, I went, you know, showed up at my office, went to turned on the computer, et cetera, and boom, I see these headlines: negative interest rates in Japan. And that was my moment at which I absolutely knew for a fact in my heart that gold and silver were on their way up. I said to myself, if I am Joe Saver, whether I'm in the U.S. or whether I'm, you know, in Japan, whether I'm Hiroshi the Saver or whatever, you know, if I go to the bank to put my money in and the bank says, oh, thank you, it's going to cost you 0.5% or 1% or 1.5% to keep your money here. We're not going to pay you any interest, but you're going to pay us for the privilege of keeping the money here. I thought I wouldn't do that. I don't think any of the listeners out there who are listening to this radio show, I don't think they would do it. What does that mean? That means I'm going to find another way of saving my money, saving my wealth, saving whatever, besides putting it in the bank. And so what I did on a personal level last January 20 and 21, and I have the statements from Fidelity and Charles Schwab to show it, I took every available dollar that I had and I bought, you know, junior mining shares with it, you know, which was a very good thing for the next, you know, 6 or 7 months on my personal investments. I turned that angle into, you know, our new newsletter at Agora Financial, The Rickards Gold Speculator. I mean, I beat the drum down in Baltimore to the publishers and said, hey, listen, guys, we really need to come up with a new newsletter on gold and silver, which we did. We launched it on May 9th of this year, and it's been a very successful newsletter as these things go. So that's kind of the promo, the advertorial part of it here. As far as the larger picture goes, negative interest rates are the death of capital. They are the death of certainly capital intensive type companies or businesses. If you're a big oil company and you need lots of money to drill $200 million wells offshore, what does that mean when you put your money in the bank and, you know, you're going to be paying the drilling company and the service company and all the workers and everything, but the bank is also nicking you for a percent or a percent and a half of that money? That destroys the economics even more of what you're trying to do. Or suppose you're an insurance company. I mean, what do you do with your insurance company? You spread the risk. People send in their premiums every month or every 3 months or whatever. And, you know, you take that money and you put it in the bank, but you need to pay that money out to cover your losses or whatever, to cover vacations that you have. And so that it destroys things like the insurance industry. I mean, and what does that do to organizations that are counting on some sort of a guaranteed return, a pension fund, you know, that use this 8% model of annual return? I mean, if you're expecting 8% return, but it costs you a percent just to keep your money in the bank, well, now all of a sudden you've just taken 12.5% off the top of what it is you're trying to do. Now you have to look for even more return. You have to take more risk with, you know, with the retiree's money or with, you know, with the pension holder's money or the insured's money, what have you. Things like that. I mean, so negative interest rates are utterly these horrible little disease vectors that get inside the body of any sort of capital type system, capital intensive type system, and they will ruin it. They will wreck it. And so that they cannot last very long without bringing us to some horrible Armageddon-like situation of the economy. And I it sounds a apocalyptic because it is apocalyptic. I think that negative interest rates are an immensely but very dangerous idea. I hope that people get over this and move on to some other semblance of monetary reality around the world. But negative interest rates are ruinous, and we must get away from them, although in the process they will be excellent for hard assets like precious metals, gold and silver.
Could you really outline an ominous path here that many of our guests have alluded to now for over almost 11 years here on the show consecutively, that people have to change their entire ontology? We have to view the world in a new way because we have entered unprecedented economic conditions. You've really sort of popped the lid on the genie's bottle here now, and I'm sure piqued the interest of many of our listeners. Can we give some potential scenarios that might unfold? For instance, with negative rates, is there any other tool in the central banker's arsenal to halt a massive credit crisis if another one were to appear? I mean, what would they do now that the ammunition is, let's say, hypothetically spent?
Back in, say, 1997 or 98, when long-term capital management blew up, Wall Street and the global banks got together and bailed out long-term capital management. Then in 10 years later, in 2008, when Wall Street and the banks blew up, the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world, you know, bailed out Wall Street and, you know, international bankers. Well, now the Fed is loaded up with a whole lot of bad debt. You know, I mean, a lot of the bonds or what have you in the portfolio of the Federal Reserve are trash. I mean, they're junk bonds. They are bonds backed by nothing. If somebody in the olden days, 100 years ago, the Pennsylvania Railroad would issue railroad bonds. Well, at least your railroad bond was backed by a railroad, with bridges and tracks and locomotives and rolling stock and stuff like that. Today, a lot of these bonds are just, they're backed by nothing because they sold bonds, raised the money, and they spent it on junk, on transfer payments, on subsidizing, failed businesses, on, salaries and overhead for government bureaucrats. They spent the money on operations and such. So it's not like those bonds are backed by anything. There's nothing there. So anyhow, where we are now is that the Fed and central banks around the world are loaded up with very, very bad debt. Who can bail those guys out? Well, I suppose it would have to be something like the International Monetary Fund with special drawing rights, the SDRs, and that would be a new form of monetary backing. But even then, I anticipate we're going to have to, when we say we, the central banks, the Federal Reserve, should prudently simply just, book a loss, just write down the value of a lot of these bonds that are never going to get repaid, and just get them off the books, write it down, just they go up in smoke and take whatever hit they take. As far as where the SDRs go, we are coming to a point starting in 2017 where the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, will together have right around 15% or more of the voting power within the International Monetary Fund, which is enough to block policy changes. And so it's not that the U.S. won't get its way with what we need. It's that we will get our way, but we were going to have to negotiate a tighter deal before these people block the policy in terms of using SDRs to help, bail out the central banks. I see a new form of global currency coming around, which would be something like a gold-backed something. I mean, I don't know if it'll be called a dollar or if it'll be called, a new dollar or if it would be called, a gold-backed seashell or a gold-backed pretty stone or something, but it's going to have some sort of physical reality, physical asset of value anchoring the value of this new currency. I hope that there are some smart people in the central banks of the world who figure this stuff out. The problem truly is that if you destroy the business model of the global insurance industry or the global reinsurance industry, people would say, oh, who cares? I can drive my car down to the supermarket and, if I don't have insurance, okay, I'm violating the state law, but it's not the end of the world. I mean, how many times have I been in a car crash? Okay, I get that. But what if you're an airline company and you fly thousands of flights a day, with your airplanes? If you don't have a solvent insurance company backing your airplanes, can you have an airline industry? No. Suppose you are the offshore drilling industry and the, and your insurance goes away. Can you still do the offshore drilling industry? No. In fact, on the Deepwater Horizon, I happen to know this. I was covering it at the time in 2010. The insurance pool that covered the Deepwater Horizon, the big disaster in the Gulf of Mexico where the BP well blew out and the Deepwater Horizon drilling vessel sank in a mile of water. The people who, the consortium that insured that Deepwater vessel had a risk profile of zero in terms of the total loss of the rig. Well, wasn't that an interesting risk profile calculation? Zero. There is zero risk of loss of the entire vessel as it sits in 6,000 feet of water now. You know, I mean, but if you don't have insurance, you can't drill, you can't mine, you can't run your railroad, you can't move the coal, you can't keep the power plant working. If just one apocalyptic scenario here, if we destroy the business model of the deep insurance industry, the big insurance and the big reinsurance industry, you destroy that with negative interest rates. All of a sudden, world commerce, global commerce shuts down overnight. And not only will you not be driving your car down to the gas station, there won't be a gas station, or there won't be any gas at the gas station. You know, so that's sort of the impact of something big on an individual.
You know, most of our grocery stores rely on just-in-time shipments from, you know, transportation, from big rigs, semis, things of that nature. If oil became scarce, and petroleum for that matter, you would see widespread shortages around the nation.
To carry that analogy, we've had hurricanes here in the United States that have affected, you know, the refinery row down on the Gulf, you know, the Gulf Coast, you know, between Houston and New Orleans. And we've had hurricanes that shut down refineries, and okay, they're down for a couple of days or a week or two, and but they get them back up and the pumps get running, and oil or the gasoline and the diesel fuel and the jet fuel, keep flowing and everything. But what happens if there's a hurricane in the insurance industry, and all of a sudden people start shutting down their refineries because they can't get insurance on them anymore? That's just one scenario that negative interest rates could, if they ruin the insurance industry, all of a sudden, if you can't insure your refinery, you can't refine. And if you can't refine, there's no fuel. We don't need a war in the Middle East. We don't need submarines, sinking the tankers like in World War II. We don't need any of that. Life as we know it will change, dramatically and quickly.
And of course, people would turn to tangible assets. Could tell our listeners more about Jim Rickard's Gold Speculator, the web address, services you all may provide, and just how they might sign up if they're inclined.
Well, we're published by a group out of Baltimore. It's one of the largest newsletter publishers in the world, Agora Financial, A-G-O-R-A, the Greek word for marketplace, Agora Financial. AgoraFinancial.com, just put us into the Google search or the Firefox search or whatever you want to do. You will find your way to the Jim Rickard's Gold Speculator because there's lots of little marks on there that you can link to. There's a sign-up page. You can do it. Now, the newsletter is it's one of the pricey newsletters, but at the same time, we've delivered a lot of value for it just in the last 6 months. I mean, I think we have very satisfied customers. We don't have too many people asking for their money back. A credit to the newsletter, if I say so myself. We cover gold and silver. I'm not talking about oil and gas. I'm not talking about uranium. I mean, sometimes I mention the word copper. Every now and then we to the extent that there is an election, we're not taking any position on Trump versus Hillary other than, if it impacts, what's going on. I mean, I think the market is priced for Hillary to win. If Trump wins, that'll be a Brexit event on steroids. Go puts on the Standard & Poor's, go long on gold. I mean, that would be that. But we avoid the politics. We avoid all this stuff. We are strictly, geology, macroeconomic, what are interest rates doing? What's the value of the dollar doing? What's gold, silver doing? And what are these optional plays of gold and silver doing? And so we focus hard on companies. And then I personally, myself, I get on an airplane and I go to Nevada and I go to Yukon and I go, all over the place in investigating these companies. I mean, I trust but verify, like, Ronald Reagan said. I go out in the field with my hard-toed boots and my hard hat, and I walk around the projects. I meet the geologists, I meet the engineers, and I come back and I write about them.
You know, you mentioned uranium. That wasn't one of your fortes. But, of course, you also know that Amir Adnani runs Uranium Energy Corp, as well as Brazil Resources, the gold company we discussed today. For folks interested in uranium, you know, Byron King, we really appreciate you bringing your wealth of knowledge here and enlightening all of us. I certainly hope that you will return to the show with more comments in 2017.
Well, I'd be glad to. I must commend you. This is the first time you and I have spoken, you know, in an interview. And I have to commend you for your questions. I mean, clearly you are deeply knowledgeable. And so when you ask really good questions, you know, you force me to come up with really good answers. I hope these were good answers, and I hope that the listeners out there enjoyed and benefited from our discussion today. So thank you. Thank you very much. Bye.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.